Okay, this hour, let's take your phone calls with our Dying Planet expert, Peter Sale, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, we're with Peter Sale, our Dying Planet. And Peter, before we get into some of our many calls here, where do we get your book, The Dying Planet?
I think you can get it at all the usual outlets. Certainly Amazon has got it, and Canada Chapters has got it, various Barnes & Noble has got it. If you go to my website, you can click directly into Amazon or Chapters, or even go directly to University of California Press, which is producing it. My website's www.petersalebooks.com, one word.
How long did it take you to write the book? I mean, how long, how many years of research? I know in my particular case, sometimes they take a few years.
I started thinking about doing it in about 2005. I thought I was fairly well along by about 2007, and I started putting some serious effort into it, and then it took longer to turn it into a book. This was the first time I had written a book for the general public. I've written books for scientists. So it's a totally different approach to how you put the words on the page. And I thought I had a book in sort of late 2009. Well, then the publishers and I got talking, and then we pulled in some experts, and I did a lot of rewriting. That probably added a year to what it took to put it together. It was a lot of work, but I'm reasonably pleased I did it. I'm sure that there are other books out there, and I think the message is really to tell people there is hope, and at the same time to tell them we have a really big problem here, and it's not one that's going to go away if we don't deal with it.
No, so. Not going to go away at all. All right, to the calls we go. We'll go to our first-time caller, Russ, is in Slidell, Louisiana. Hey, Russ, thanks for calling.
Hi, George. Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Good to talk to you, Russ.
Yes, we went through Katrina. It tore down a Lake Pontchartrain Bridge. We're tearing it up. They're pulling the bric-a-brac out. I don't know where they're putting it, but I know they farm coral in you know, certain areas. Can, you know, and they're building a pier. Can coral grow in a brackish water? And also, could we take that bric-a-brac and put it even further out towards the Gulf and build coral and grow it on that bric-a-brac, on that busted up concrete, and make it grow and build up? I know they've built domes, and they've constructed like round pieces to build coral in this Pontchartrain Lake, but I know it's not salt water, it's brackish. And you know, I'm just wondering if our lake can be a coral reef.
Yeah, if you're talking about in the lake, and I do not know the area. I've only been in New Orleans once, and I spent most of my time going to really nice restaurants, so I don't know the environment. But if you're talking about the lake, one of the things corals require, they require good seawater. Brackish water will kill them really quickly, so it's not a solution for that. But coral certainly will grow on an artificial rocky surface. So it's possible to build structures that provide the basement that the corals can grow on. And sometimes rocky reefs built as breakwaters can become quite well covered by corals and provide a very effective environment for corals and coral-associated animals to live in.
I've seen them farm them on grates, like they break them up and they propagate them.
Yeah,
is that true?
Yeah, now you got to be a little bit careful. There's a lot of enthusiasm at the moment for taking coral and breaking it up and propagating it and planting it out. Frequently, that's a lot of wasted effort. Frequently, it's better to improve the situation so that the natural regeneration will occur. And in terms of spending money, it's a more effective way of spending the money. Oftentimes, where people make mistakes is they set up a big program to take coral, break it into small pieces, put it out in a sort of a coral nursery, grow it big enough, and then plant it in a place where they're trying to replace coral which has died, but they haven't got rid of the reason the coral is dying. And so all you're doing there is you're taking other coral and spending a little bit of time looking after it and then putting it in a place where it's going to be killed. So replenishment or regeneration is certainly a tool which we can use, but it is not the answer to the situation we're facing, the sort of massive impacts we're having on reefs. We need better tools than that one.
What do you think of aqua farms as they're trying to grow large salmon artificially, basically?
You mean in the pen cultivation where they're in sea cages? They do produce salmon, which is quite tasty to eat. If they are managed, so often the answer is it depends how it's done. If they're managed well so that they do not become a source of pollution, if they are not so crowded one against another that they become a source of disease, which can then migrate out to fish outside the cages, if fish farming is done well, it is a very effective way of aquaculture for fish. If it is not done well, it creates a whole bunch of problems. And, you know, frequently it's not done well. I think it's done well on the west coast of Canada, the U.S. We've got reasonably responsible practitioners, and we've got reasonably vigorous enforcement agencies. So that the management is well done. You get to some other countries where the situation is not quite so well established, and the conditions are a lot less good.
All right, next up, let's go to our wild card line. Randy in Baltimore, Maryland, you're on with us. Hi, Randy, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, guys. How you doing? George, you got a great show. I love it.
Thank you.
George had a guest, Elizabeth, I can't pronounce her name, Plorty, and there's a couple articles on the internet was saying that the sunscreen is killing the coral reefs. I hadn't heard you mention that. Do you think that's plausible?
Yeah. Chemicals.
One of the things you'll find in good tourist destinations now is that they will push people to use sunscreens that don't contain some of the chemicals which are harmful to corals, and they will encourage people to use sunscreens which are non-toxic and biodegradable. There is a problem when you have large numbers of people in the water near things like reefs. If we slather ourselves with sunscreen and jump in the water and swim around, we're really just dumping the sunscreen into the ocean. And, it can have an effect.
Next up, Leslie's in Santa Cruz, California, and you're on Coast to Coast. Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
My question is this. Years ago, the surf used to look so pristine to me. And now in some of the beaches, it looks so dirty. And I just wonder if this is my imagination or if it really is coming in a lot more dirty than it used to be.
You should read the chapter in my book about shifting baselines. Shifting baselines is a term that scientists developed to explain how it is that we don't notice that things are changing and getting worse. And we tend not to notice how bad they've got because we're remembering just from a short time ago. You're apparently good enough that you can remember when it was cleaner.
Yeah.
And, it's got dirtier. You're not imagining it. One of the problems with things like environmental degradation is these are changes which happen slowly. And because they happen slowly, we don't notice they're happening. And one of the things that concerns me is that my graduate students have grown up with coral reefs, which are far less pristine than the ones I grew up with. They don't know pristine coral reefs because they've never seen them. And their graduate students in the next generation will not even know the reefs that are as good as the ones that my students knew. It is a slow process of degradation, and it is happening in the environment all around us because of pollution, because of over-exploitation, just because of the different things we do that damage it. And the world is less the way it could be.
Why are they in salt water and not just regular old lake water?
Because they're saltwater animals. I mean,
right.
that's a why is the sky blue question. I'm sure we could delve into their physiology and why they can't survive in fresh water. But there are lots and lots of marine organisms that can't live in fresh water. Similarly, there are freshwater organisms can't live in the ocean. Frogs are very happy swimming around in a lake. Put frogs in the ocean, they shrivel up and die. So it's just that. Salt water and fresh water are different kinds of places, and only a few organisms can move between them, and they do it by some very clever physiological tricks to make it possible.
Okay, back to the phones we go. Tom's in Festus, Missouri. Hey, Tom, go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning. Good morning.
I'd just like to talk to you about the coral reefs you mostly been speaking about are in the Caribbean and Mexico. Those reefs I studied back in the 80s, and now they're really destroyed. If you want to see a good coral reef besides Australia, the South Pacific is the place to go.
Mm-hmm.
And currently right now I am doing some quite successful fragmentation of several species of coral, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that, for example, in the Philippines, where they use dynamite to fish, they have done some success in rebuilding their coral reefs.
Yes, they have. I know some of the people who've been doing that work, yeah.
Right. A gentleman named Daniel Knopp and some other people from iClarm who are actually farming giant clams.
Yep.
They're doing some great work down there.
And, you know, farming giant clams is a wonderful thing to do because they basically farm themselves. You sit them out on the reef and leave them in the warm water with the sun shining down, and they've got the symbiotic algae in their tissues. The algae do all their photosynthesis, and the clam grows, and then you harvest it. It's a great... And they don't run around because they're sitting on the bottom and they can't move. And so,
and they use huge amounts.
They're an ideal animal to farm.
Yeah, they use huge amounts of nutrients, clean the water. And
yep.
The other benefit is for the aquarium industry, people who like to have saltwater reef tanks love these beautiful clams. George, you've probably never seen one. When you go to Hawaii or next time you're in St. Louis.
Uh-huh.
There's a pet shop in St. Charles, Missouri, and they sell marine organisms, which I'm not a real big fan of saltwater aquarium trade.
But they are pretty.
Right, and they have some beautiful clams there. They're jewels. But there is hope for this, and unfortunately, though, there isn't much hope for the Gulf of Mexico, not only because it's not warm enough, except for perhaps the Keys of Florida. That one gentleman was asking about Lake Pontchartrain. Besides being fresh water, it's just the temperature there just isn't
too cold. Yeah,
yeah, it's way too cold. The Gulf of Mexico is probably, with the exception of Belize, is probably gone. But George, when you go to Hawaii, you'll have a great chance to see a lot of nice stuff, especially if you go south of there. There's a place called Kingman Reef, which is probably the most beautiful reef left in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to point out that there is some hope out there.
I think that's a very good point you raise, and it's one I should have made at some point in this discussion. Not all reefs are the same. There are some reefs around the world that have been impacted much harder by us than other reefs. There are places where the reefs are still in relatively good condition. There are some reefs that are probably much like they were 100 years ago. They're few and far between, but they're the jewels we have to protect, and they're the reefs that tell us what we should have everywhere else. And the Caribbean is a situation where the changes that have occurred in the Caribbean in the last 25 years, 30 years, are incredible. The enormously big branching coral, the Elkhorn coral, Acropora palmata, it was so important in the Caribbean reefs that if you look at a technical description of the structure of a coral reef in the Caribbean, they have different zones of the reef from the surface down to deeper water, and they talk about these zones, and they have names. And the uppermost zone, the one where the waves are breaking, was called the Palmata Zone. And it was called the Palmata Zone because this coral produced these ramparts of these enormous branches of coral. It was almost like, if you could get into it, it was almost like moving through a cathedral with all these arches over you. Absolutely beautiful. I've seen it once like that, because I never got to the Caribbean until the 80s. I've seen it once on the south coast of Cuba. I have not seen the ramparts of Elkhorn coral that used to be typical of coral reefs all across the Caribbean. That species is now on the endangered species list because of diseases, because of warming. Those two things particularly, it's on its way out, and it's a tragedy.
Well, and I can see how you are so concerned about this, Peter, and at the same time, hopeful that this is going to get fixed. Mm-hmm. And I hope you're right about that.
Well, people can take several reactions to what I'm talking about. They can say, oh, it's not nearly important enough for me to worry about. I've got other things to worry about. To hell with it. You know, that's one attitude. Unfortunately, that's not a very helpful attitude. And if everybody takes that attitude, we're not going to fix it. Or they can get really concerned and depressed. That's not productive. There's no point in being depressed about it. What we should be doing, if anything, is be angry about it. We should be furious that we have allowed ourselves to get into this situation.
All right, Peter, hold on for a second.
Struggling to do something about it.
We're coming back for final phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to talk about black magic, voodoo. Make sure you're part of that show. And when we come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM with Peter Sale, we will take your final phone calls in just a moment. And welcome back. We're with Peter Sale, the name of his book, Our Dying Planet. Peter, though I try to take a positive outlook about everything, part of me thinks that one day we could have major wars to reduce this planet's population from the 6.8 to up to the 9 billion by that time, as you said, down to a few billion people, maybe a million, maybe 500 million. Who knows? I see that as a possibility if they don't fix this.
I think there is a possibility of that. In fact, there's a book I've just finished reading by, Parenti, Christian Parenti. It's called Tropic of Chaos, and he ascribes climate impacts as causing much of the strife that we see around the world at the present time. Yes, if you create situations, or if situations become severe so that people do not have the access to the food and water they need and other resources as well, one of the ways people solve that problem is by fighting over it. And, you know, we've done that through history. I know that our population problem will be solved, even if we do nothing about it, but it will be solved by disease and pestilence and war and famine.
Yeah.
And I think that that's not the way to solve it. I mean, that's pretty unpleasant. I'm much more in favor of finding a way to curtail the production of people rather than the early elimination of people, and which is what war does. But the situation is severe enough that international relations are going to be challenged. And many of the leaders, many of the politicians who make decisions in countries, the people who make decisions about security and international strategy and all those sorts of things, they're aware of the environmental crisis. They're aware of the threats it poses in terms of illegal immigration, mm-hmm. the threats it poses in terms of severe problems of drought and starvation. You remember when the granaries of the world in, you know, the U.S., Canada, Australia, Russia were full of grain? And it was, you know, a year's supply of grain sure. sitting around, and it would be shipped around the world to feed people. It's all gone because the conditions have changed with some of the severe droughts that have occurred in places like Australia. We haven't got that sort of backstop of stored food. It doesn't exist anymore. It's not because the farmers aren't trying to grow food. It's because it's harder to grow it. The situation in the world is quite serious. However, if we understand that it's serious and understand why it's serious, then there's the possibility we can encourage our leaders to put themselves at the front of the parade and move forward and get things fixed. And that's the challenge at the moment, getting enough people to believe that there is a problem and that we need to do something about it. They don't have to understand what we need to do, but there needs to be enough people knowing that we need to do something. That will push the political crowd to start thinking about things that have consequences 10 years into the future instead of next year. And that's what we need in the world.
They should be doing the right thing, but I'm not so sure they will, Peter.
Well, I mean, yeah, I'm not so sure that they will either, but I would prefer to argue the value of doing the right thing and cling to the optimistic hope that people, when they finally realize there's a problem, will do the right thing. And because if that isn't possible, then we're far simpler creatures than we thought we were.
Let's go to Mike, truck driving in New Mexico. Mike, go ahead.
Hello, hi. Mr. Sale. I do have to disagree with you on one thing, and that's the overpopulation.
Okay.
There's been numerous reports on the last couple of years that the actual growth in population has shrunken, and most namely the United States is less than 2.0 replacement for the population for every two people.
Yeah.
It's, we're actually slowing down our population growth, and the population is shrinking, if you want to be honest.
Yeah.
In most of the developing countries.
In fact, the population growth is slowing down. That's quite true. But the world population is not yet shrinking. It's growing at the rate of about 228,000 people a, I forget if it's a day or, no, it's a year.
And that's primarily because there aren't enough developed countries on this planet, right?
No, it's the developed countries, many of them have got a situation, if it's, for instance, both Canada and the U.S. have got internal replacement, in other words, births happening to families living in the country that are not sufficient to keep the population the size it is. In other words, the population will get smaller, except we have immigration to balance it out, and we have slight growth in our population because of the combination of internal births and then immigration. But
what about underdeveloped countries?
But yes, but that's the problem. Then you move into developing countries, and you don't have that situation. Outside of Europe and North America, with a couple of situations in Africa where the country is suffering very severely from AIDS primarily and other diseases, so that the mortality rate has been quite high, and you have populations declining. All the other countries in the world, the populations are growing, and the growth is such. I'm just looking for a piece of information that I thought I had handy. The world fertility is now 2.5, which means that a couple is producing 2.5 children, which is more than you need to replace them when they die of old age. The average for the world is 2.5 per pair of people. You need 2.1 for the population to remain constant. And that may not seem like a very big difference, but it's about a 16% difference. And the population is getting bigger at that rate. You know, it's one of those things that we were taught never to talk about it. During the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, it became politically incorrect to suggest there was a population problem because people interpreted that as sort of people in the rich countries criticizing the poor countries for their high birth rates. But we need to talk about it because it is a major part of the problem.
Sure.
The other part of the problem, of course, is those of us in the rich countries who may not have lots of population growth, we use way more than the individuals living in the poor countries.
That's true.
We need to change our pattern of use so that we're much more efficient, much more recycling, much less of this use, consume, throw away. And we need to encourage other countries to find ways of reducing their population growth so that they get quicker to an equilibrium. I personally would like to see a world with, you know, maybe 3 billion, 3.5, 4 billion people. I think 6.9 is more than enough, and 9.2 billion people on the planet really frightens me.
Right, as long as we don't get down to that number by annihilation.
Yeah, we don't want to do that. I'm not in favor of encouraging war or other kinds of strife. I don't want to increase mortality rates. I want people to be born, live healthy lives, live long lives that are productive lives in an environment which is culturally attractive. That's what I want.
First time caller, we'll go to Oxnard, California. Hey, Benjamin, go ahead.
Hi, George, you made a parallel earlier on in the show of between Dr. Cobwell and his the cancer and treating it, or the
alkaline level. Yeah.
Yeah, and I was curious. I'd be interested to see the two studies compared between Peter. I'm sorry, I don't recall your last name, but between Peter's study of the bleaching effect of the reef and the acidity in the body, and how the two of them together, and like, I guess I'm just curious about the what the correlation would be if the two studies were put side by side.
I would guess, Peter, that the acidic level around dying coral would be pretty high.
Yes. Well, actually, no. It depends. There has been actually serious discussion within the scientific community about using the term ocean acidification, because, in fact, you know, you measure acidity by pH, and the pH scale goes from 1 to 14, and 7 is neutral, and anything below 7 is acidic, and anything above 7 is basic. And seawater is at about 8, and it's drifted down towards 7.8. It's a very small shift. It's a shift in the direction of becoming acidic, but it's still on the non-acidic side of neutral. So it's probably quite different. I think it's interesting to draw the parallel, and there may well be some things we can learn about it. And I don't know the study and the cancer study. I don't know any of the details of it, so I can't comment. But often you can learn things, you can get insights by looking at things that are so very, very different, and you'll see some commonalities. But this is a very simple case where simply you have shifted the pH of the environment in such a way that the chemical processes require more energy to shift the calcium and the carbonate towards becoming the solid. And in order to produce that solid skeleton, the organisms have got to use more energy to do it. And so, you know, they don't have ample supplies of extra energy, so they have to do it more slowly.
You know, I'm a believer in the Gaia theory, Peter. I believe this planet is alive. It's an organism, and I think it fights back. And I think one of the things it will do before we get to this dying planet is it will make some horrendous changes on itself, on this planet.
I think that's perfectly possible. I don't think we are in a situation where in a short period of time there's going to be no life on Earth. That's not what I mean. The planet we know is threatened by dying. It'll be replaced by a planet we don't know, a planet that has life on it, but the kinds of ecological systems that exist at the present time are going to be severely changed. And, you know, each time the Earth has gone through these mass extinction events, and there have been 5 of them, you know, the most recent was at the end of the Cretaceous when all the last of the dinosaurs disappeared and a whole bunch of other things, but there's been 4 others. In each of these mass extinctions, there was a radical reorganization of what happened next, because the few kinds of organisms that managed to get through the bad conditions, then you have a different mix of species, and so things become quite different. It's quite likely we wouldn't be here if it hadn't been for the mass extinction in the Cretaceous, because that's what allowed the mammals to sort of take over from the reptiles. If there hadn't been that mass extinction, there'd probably still be dinosaurs lumbering around, and the mammals would be little tiny shrews and rodents keeping out of sight so they didn't get eaten. But the loss of all those big predatory dinosaurs led to a period where where the mammals had the opportunity to speciate and become a lot more elaborated, and of course eventually some of them started walking around on their back legs and thinking they understood everything.
Let's go to Brian in Jefferson City, Missouri. We'll get your question in. Go ahead, Brian.
Hey, George. My question for Peter is, what kind of effect, in his opinion, is the Asian carp going to have when it eventually makes it up into the Great Lakes and the effects on the fisheries and stuff up there?
Oh, the Asian carp, yes. We are very good at putting species where they don't belong. We do it purposely sometimes. A long time ago, people took rabbits and foxes to Australia because they wanted it to be like England. And the foxes didn't become too much of a problem, but the rabbits became an enormous problem. And we've done that time and again. The Asian carp is actually a deliberate introduction in the sense that they were brought in live as food. They've escaped. They are probably going to get into the Great Lakes, and they will have an impact. Precisely how serious an impact, I don't know, because it will, the Great Lakes, it's further north than the Mississippi drainage, so they may not do as well as they've done further south, but I know that the fisheries management agencies are quite worried about them. But we've done this before, and until we get smart, we'll continue doing it. We've got a wonderful thing going on in the, well, wonderful is probably the wrong word, a dreadful thing going on in the Caribbean right now with the lionfish, which is a beautiful fish with big stripes on its fins, and it's got poisonous spines on its fins as well. It's a voracious predator of small fish. It lives on coral reefs in the Pacific, where it is part of the natural system. Got introduced into the Caribbean accidentally by aquarium releases, because it's a wonderful fish for an aquarium, but it got out. And it's taken off in the last 5 or 6 years, and is spreading right through the Caribbean, down the coast of Brazil, up the coast of North Carolina. What its final impact is going to be, we don't know, but it doesn't belong there.
We will find out. And Peter, I want to thank you for educating us, not only about the situation with the planet, but coral reefs. I mean, I finally learned a lot about coral reefs, and thank you so much. The book is called Our Dying Planet. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Tim Banal, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.